Tonight's speaker is a wonderful speaker who has used this library often, Dr. Nicole Robertson. I'd like to welcome back. She's going to talk to us tonight on women's work, clothing and women's emancipation in the early 20th century, which I take a particular interest in myself, so I'll be delighted. There are evaluation forms from the project on the chair, so it'd be really great if you could fill those in for the project as well. Turn your thumbs off and all that, if you could, that'd be great. But without further ado, I shall hand you over to the wonderful Nicole. So I think we can give her a round of applause to get her on stage.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much, Stefan, for those very kind words. Stefan said, I've been to the library on quite a number of occasions and I really like coming here. It's a great environment, so Vika and I were delighted that we were able to include the Bishopsgate in our tailored trades project. So I'm going to speak for about 40, 45 minutes and there's going to be time for questions at the end. And as Stefan said, the topic that I'm talking about today is sort of women's work, more specifically clothing, women's emancipation in the early 20th century. So what I'm looking at is the links and the interconnections between clothing and women's emancipation, specifically sort of issues concerned with political and economic emancipation of women in the early 20th century, gender roles and identity, and professional communities. So this paper tonight focuses on the way in which clothes, far from being on the edges of these debates, actually was of great significance. And what I've done for the paper this evening is divided the talk into three parts. So the first part looking at the wardrobes of suffragettes, secondly looking at the First World War and women's dress, and then the final section looking at the white blouse revolution, so looking at female clerical workers. So, first of all then, the wardrobes of the suffragettes. So, when assessing the extent to which women's dress reflected newfound freedoms in the early 20th century, there's been a lot of very interesting work on the sort of 1914 to 18 period during the First World War, which I'm going to come to in the second part of the presentation tonight. And this was certainly a period which sort of laid the foundations for a much freer style of dress for women. But what I'm going to look at first is the role played by clothing to reappraise women's positions in society during the period immediately preceding the First World War, specifically on the role of clothing in the campaigns of the suffragettes. So most Edwardians subscribe to this ideology of two spheres, that the woman's place was in the home, in the private sphere, and that the public domain was the world of men, of work, and of politics, and the two were separate. The women's movement had a huge impact on Edwardian society on many different levels. It shocked it to some extent into reappraising the role of women. So women proved their strength in fundraising, propaganda, organisation and publicity stunts. Founded in 1903 by the Pankhurst family, which you can see upon the screen there, two of the daughters and Emmeline, the Women's Social and Political Union, the WSPU, was the most radical branch of the women's movement during the early years of the 20th century. And what they sought to do was wake up the nation to the cause of women's suffrage through deeds, not words. British suffragettes were mostly from upper middle class backgrounds, frustrated by the social and economic situations that they found themselves in, and campaigned for change within society. So it was founded in Manchester in 1903, but they relocated their headquarters to London in 1906. And then for the next 8 years, the fight to win the vote became a very highly public and sometimes violent struggle played out against the backdrop of Edwardian London. So by taking their campaigns to the streets, the WSPU attracted maximum publicity, and their highly identifiable colour scheme, the purple, green and white, became quite a familiar sight in central London during the years before the First World War. It was in the spring of 1908 when the WSPU launched the colour scheme with which it would be identified. The WSPU treasurer at the time stated that suffragettes should wear three colours at all times so that the public would instantly recognise them and the cause for which they fought. Purple was said to represent the colour of dignity, white of purity and green of hope for the future. Votes for Women, which was the WSPU's own newspaper, declared that we heartily urge all those who can do so to make a special effort to wear the uniform. It will consist of a short skirt of purple or green, a white jersey golf coat and a simple hat of purple or green. The regalia will be worn over the right shoulder and will be fastened under the left arm. And they described this as the uniform of the suffragettes. This sort of purple, green and white colour scheme was first used at the WSPU's demonstration in June 1908. And this was what was considered a monster meeting, which brought thousands of suffragettes from all over the country in specially chartered trains down to London. There were several processions that marched through the capital to the rally in Hyde Park, where they heard over 70 speakers. And we can see some of the images. Now, the problem with the sources at this time is obviously they're mainly black and white. So we can't get quite the impression of what these women look like. But I think the black and white photos, you can see the different shades for the different colours. And then here's a more modern photograph of one of the banners here. So this uniform, as the suffragettes called it, of purple, white and green, was designed to unite members with a strong sense of identity and common purpose. The colours became instantly recognisable. Clothing can be an important vehicle for social communication. I think this was certainly the case with the suffragettes. So as Elizabeth Rouse in her work on understanding fashion states, clothing signs are very important as signs of social participation and the degree of an individual's active and willing participation. So wearing these colours, the purple, white and green, quickly caught on with WSPU supporters who dressed in these colours. Retailers and entrepreneurs also identified that suffragettes could, of course, be valuable customers with, quite importantly, money to spend. So they stocked a wide variety of the purple, white and green fashion items. Never one to miss out on an opportunity, Selfridge released this. Very moving advert. Suffragettes must not be dowdy. So he gets right to the point. How can they combat this? Well, of course, they can go to Selfridges, where fashionable young women are flocking, this is by Selfridges' own admission, to the department store, as it says, for delicate tea dresses and that most powerful symbol of female emancipation, red lipstick. So he identifies himself very strongly with the cause, or maybe more precisely with the money and customs of the suffragettes. So another important reason why there was this colour scheme was the WSPU also produced various items. We've got some here. They sold these scarves, which could be worn across the neck, also to keep the hats in place. The money then raised would go to the WSPU cause. Other retailers also cashed in, so to speak, on this. So these are some of the items that I've found. There was suffragette bags in the green, purple and white, also playing cards, for example. So the suffragette uniform ensured that these women were highly visible and smart looking. It also raised money for the WSPU. As historians have pointed out, proper clothes suggest sort of proper behaviour, and suffragettes did not wish to be derived as unwomanly. The WSPU leadership urged women to wear their clothes in as fetching, charming and ladylike manner as possible. Those who campaigned against women's suffrage often depicted suffragettes as drab and badly dressed. The anti-suffrage movement was quick in seeking to deride the suffragettes over sort of their appearance. They articulated their attack by creating images or characterisations of suffragettes. This one at the top, you can see suffragettes who have never been kissed. You can see that their hats are on a funny angle. The neckerchiefs are quite large. They've got quite masculine faces. Again, here as well, a suffragette preaching. again, it's quite sort of more old-fashioned clothes and with quite a masculine face, that most of these images shared that in common. Now, Suffragettes retaliated in this cartoon, which is one of my favourites. Here, the suffragette gets her own back on the Anti-Suffrage Society, AS, as you can see here, and specifically mentions clothing. So you can see it's actually the Anti-Suffrage Society trying to make the suffragette wear old-fashioned clothing and saying, well, I'm sure it would suit you and fit. I've made it exactly after your grandmother's pattern. So here is the suffragettes using clothing to say, well, actually, we're the modern and progressive voice here, and it's the Anti-Suffrage Society that's trying to hold things back. So the suffragettes certainly challenged traditional notions of gender roles in Edwardian society. However, some historians have argued that it was actually the First World War which most strongly influenced the development of women's rights in the 20th century Britain. So the war certainly opened up new opportunities for many women who replaced the millions of men who were sent to fight. Jobs, for example, in factories, transport, the police and on the land. These new opportunities in the workplace required new types of clothing and new uniform. So during the period of the First World War, the history of labour and dress are very much closely entwined. Although the First World War did provide these new opportunities for women in the labour market, it must be noted that the immediate effect of the outbreak of the war was actually a drastic increase in unemployment among women. This was due mainly to the fact that many of the industries which in peacetime had employed large numbers of women were initially hard hit by the outbreak of the war. So, for example, industries in the cotton trade, sort of contractors as employees and clients hesitated, waiting to see what developments there were going to be politically and also in the economy. As an economy measure, many wealthy households dismissed domestic servants, which was also a large area of employment for many working class women, and they cut their order temporarily to sort of luxury trades like jewellery, millinery, dressmaking, all areas where female labour had been traditionally employed. As men enlisted, however, what first of all happened was that women were employed van drivers, as window cleaners, as shop assistants, at first often informally, simply taking the places of husbands, fathers and brothers. But the expansion of women into the labour market most noticeably occurred more formally after the introduction of conscription to men, which was in January 1916. So, as Gail Braeburn in her book Women Workers in the First World War points out, by 1917 women were spread throughout industry. So where did these women come from? Well, Braeburn notes that the main effect of the war was to bring about a transference of women between trades and the return of those previously excluded. So generally married women had been excluded from work. So there was over 200,000 women who went into industry during the war came from domestic service or the clothing trades, traditional areas of employment for women in this period. These trades could not compete with the engineering and explosive industries, which appeared to offer new opportunities and more money. For example, it was reported that London dressmakers found it very hard to get female apprentices by 1917 because of the competition offered by other industries. And they actually contacted the LCC and labour exchanges with a view to looking into reducing their hours to make dressmaking more attractive. Other workers in industry during the war were married women who, once they'd got married, had been removed from the economy. They were told they should not work, that their role was in the home. Now, during the wartime, there was a need for more workers, and these women were welcomed back. It must be pointed out that a large number of working class women in the workforce was obviously not new. Working class women had needed to work. But the jobs they undertook during the war were different. Also, you have for the first time many middle class women began earning a living. So So by the end of the war, 1 million more women were at work than they had been in the summer of 1914. Most of them were in jobs previously done by men who were now in the armed forces. So they worked as railway porters, land girls, carpenters, mechanics, police women and munition workers. So what I want to do now, after providing that context to women's employment, is to have a look at the type of clothing these new roles necessitated. So new demands placed on women meant new demands for dress. The uniforms worn by women in areas such as the police service, on railways, on trams, were very similar in style to men's uniforms. They're also quite similar in the fabric that was used. The styles were fairly bulky, but they were comfortable. They were also worn with a fairly short skirt. The style acknowledged women's need to move around, to have freedom of movement, and they tended to play down certain feminine aspects of appearance as had been associated with clothing during the Edwardian period. So you can see here these images on your left are female police officers in their uniform. They're being inspected. This here is Mary Allen. She appears here as well. She was, she'd been a suffragette. She had actually been imprisoned three times during the period before the First World War for breaking windows in government buildings. When the war broke out, she joined the police force. I quite like her story. She's a very feisty woman. So she was the commander here. You can see that the uniform is very similar to that which would have worn by a man. Obviously, they're wearing skirts, not trousers. We'll come to trousers in a moment. Again, the picture here, I've put this picture up because you could see again the skirt is sort of calf length here. And again, the style of the uniform, the material used is quite similar to the male version. So these changing needs in the economy because of the war brought about large numbers of women into jobs that they hadn't previously done, hadn't previously had the opportunity to do. They were issued with loose-fitting, even shapeless clothes for the first time. Women required practical clothing designed for service and protection rather than for decoration. Pamphlets issued to factory workers advised very strongly against the wearing of stiff corsets or stiff clothing and heavy skirts because they said these restricted movement and ultimately in those environments they could be quite dangerous. Although it was considered quite daring at first, during the war it became acceptable that women should wear trousers for what they called rough tasks. So this was perhaps quite the sort of what we can think of as the greatest innovation in women's dress during the war years. Now, trousers had been worn by some women prior to the war. For example, the pitbrow lasses of the 19th century wore trousers. However, during the First World War, they became more common wear in certain professions. Many photographs show women delivery girls, mechanics, munitions workers in trousers and boiler suits. Trousers were no longer completely taboo for women, and they were only considered suitable in certain circumstances. So I'm going to look now at munition workers and land girls in more detail and the type of clothing that they wore. So perhaps the most famous of women workers in the First World War were those employed in munitions factories. By the middle of the war, there was around 75,000 women employed in the munitions industry. The days were long, but the wages were higher than most girls had been accustomed to in, for example, domestic service, where a lot of these women had previously worked. However, the work was incredibly dangerous. When working with explosives, women required special clothing. So girls would wear rubber gum boots or wooden clogs, and this was so that no sparks would be caused when they were moving. They had a flame retardant overall or with a canvas overall with a belt, and they also wore caps to prevent injuries getting their hair caught. So you can see in this post that's quite commonly associated with women's work in the First World War, the cap and the overall. And here, this photo shows actually a picture of women at work with the overalls and the caps. So caps and overalls did look strange to those who were used to seeing women working in their own clothing. The work required high levels of mobility, and so the overalls were eventually supplanted by trousers. And it was this item of clothing that was often worn as a sort of badge of honour, so to speak, on the streets by munition girls. It was often glamorised in recruitment posters. So what I've got here is two images. The cartoon version and the reality. So what you can see on the left is a cartoon there. You should see how the girls fill them. It's quite obvious what the point is of that. You can see deep purple, quite glamorous looking trousers. And then this is a photograph of munitions workers themselves. So you can see that very much fit for purpose clothing. The sort of darker colour and fitted obviously in a very different way. These were clothes that were very much for protection and service. They were very much practical, not glamorous. Now, the idea, this romanticised or glamorous view of war work in munitions work was quite common. For example, a writer for the Weekly Welcome journal assured readers who were potential recruits in an article about life as a munitionette that, I quote here, the yellow colouring which appears on the skin is in no way affects health and will disappear when the work is given up for a week or so. Now, we know that's not actually the case. The yellow stains on the skin came from handling TNT, which was highly, highly toxic, and some women were seriously affected by it. TNT was highly explosive. By far the worst explosion occurred near here in Silvertown Munitions Factory in London's East End. This explosion happened on the 19th of January 1917. Approximately 50 tonnes of TNT exploded. It killed all the women who were in the factory at the time. When the explosion happened, there was only 73 people present at work on that afternoon. So whilst being a horrific incident for those women and their families, the casualty list could have been a lot higher. It was the fact that most of the women had already left when the explosion happened. So 73 people were killed by this, and over 400 people nearby were injured. The explosion ripped through the factory instantly. The factory was destroyed. You can see the site where it used to stand. And there were over 900 homes near the plant were also destroyed or very badly damaged in the disaster, leaving thousands of people homeless. The factory itself was in a built-up area, as you can see in this image. So these were the houses. This was where the factory was. So this really highlighted to people, certainly in the area, that munitions work was very serious work and it was highly dangerous. So next I'm going to turn to land girls. So for centuries, women had worked on the land, dairies, butter making were quite common occupations for women when they did work on the land. But before the First World War, women's agricultural work was mainly seasonal and casual. As more men were called up for military service and with the high casualties of war, there was an acute shortage of labour for the production of food. The Women's Land Army was established to meet this need. It was a national organisation and it was formed to place women in agricultural work to replace the men who were called up for military service. Women who worked for the Women's Land Army were commonly known as land girls. By 1918, the Land Army had just over 12,500 members. Work in the Women's Land Army required fitting these land girls out with appropriate clothing. So the uniform issued to members of the Land Army consisted of knee-length overall, boots, a hat and breeches. So you can see the image on the left illustrates that. You can just make out here the breeches under the overcoat and they're more obvious here because the coat is a lot shorter. So for these workers, the significance of clothing and labour were closely entwined with concerns regarding appropriate dress and behaviour of women. So as Neil Storey and Molly Housegar in their History of Women in the First World War point out, the importance of the work of the Land Army was appreciated, but there were concerns in some quarters about the girls, they said, losing their femininity because of the clothing they were wearing. So this was not because, you might think, because of the very hard nature of the work, but because of girls wore breeches. These concerns were recognised by the Land Army Handbook, and it pointed out to girls, "You are doing a man's work, and so you're dressed rather like a man. But remember, just because you wear a smock and breeches, you should take care to behave like a British girl who expects chivalry and respect from everyone she meets." So here we can see that clothing is very much attached to ideas about women's traditional roles and how women should behave and what's acceptable behaviour for a woman and how that should be different from a man. So the Land Girls' practical sort of short hairstyle also and their breeches and trousers were commented on, and some people greatly disapproved of this. There were letters of complaint published in local and national newspapers, and there were concerns, for example, of girls going out without the overalls on, so that the breeches were quite visible. Following the end of the war, there was a backlash against women in the workplace. Many men wished to see women back in their peacetime roles as wives and as mothers, not as uniformed workers. The desire for women to return back to the home led to much propaganda concerning the roles of housewives and the importance of domesticity. And these concerns about the women's roles in the aftermath of the war often used clothing as a vehicle to express those. So this Land Girl poster that we can see here, this was published at the end of the war, and it serves to highlight this. So in it you can see the Land Girl pondering to herself, after the war problems, shall I still wear them, i.e. the breeches, or shall I get married? Clear-cut issue here. The wearing of breeches was necessary for her work during the First World War. In the aftermath of war, it was deemed incompatible with women's traditional domestic duties. So the clothing here was very much used as a focus of post-war propaganda to try and get women back into the home. So as explored in this section, new job opportunities for women during the First World War required new uniforms and new clothing. Workwear was designed to be practical. It was designed to be suited to a variety of tasks that women had not previously been involved in. Whilst it was often unflattering, it was comfortable, and the garments provided women with freedom of movement. So traditional heavy skirts would have obviously been impractical in munitions factories and out on the land. They restricted movement, and they could be dangerous for many of the tasks that women undertook. However, I think we've got to be careful in equating the First World War with the liberation of women, and this is far too a simplistic view of the situation. Many of the apparent advances made in the workplace were often illusionary, in that many women were dismissed and they lost their jobs once the war ended and the demobilised soldiers returned to Britain. Women continue to face barriers to equal pay and also equal access to certain professions despite the Sex Disqualification Removal Act of 1919, which in theory at least made it illegal to exclude women from jobs because of their gender. The Representations of the People Act in 1918 at the end of the First World War gave women the franchise for the first time, but some have argued that this was a reward for women's wartime work. However, the so-called democratic franchise of 1918 only gave the vote to women who were over 30 and had property. Now, the majority of munitions workers, for example, had been women under the age of 30. So this takes me to the final section, the final third of the presentation tonight, on the white blouse revolution and female clerical work. So after the First World War, many working class women were forced back into poorly paid jobs in the textiles industry, in clothing and domestic service, jobs which had traditionally been regarded as women's work. However, the new post-war world, did give rise to some new opportunities for single women of working class and lower middle class origins, particularly in typing and in clerical work. And it was this shift to what became known as the white blouse revolution, or white blouse work. It was a trend that had begun in the later Victorian years, and it became a major feature in the changing occupational structure and distribution of women. So from the 1870s, the white blouse revolution, as it became known, was created due to a number of growth areas. So retail stores, you get the growth of department stores in this period, civil service and local government, and then also the expanding scope of industrial and commercial enterprises meant that there was an ever-growing amount of office work that needed to be done. From the 1870s onwards, the general trend in clerical employment was feminisation. As the sector expanded, men lost their monopoly of this form of work, and women, with fewer and maybe less palatable alternatives, flocked to it. Meta Zimmick, in her work on the expansion of clerical work for women, estimates that the number of women clerks rose from just about 2,000 in 1851 to 166,000 by 1911. By 1914, so just by the outbreak of the First World War, this was a sector that was on the cusp of transition from man's work to a woman's sphere of work. However, although this type of work did afford new opportunities to women, it should be noted that women were generally employed in the what might be seen as the least desirable work. So mechanical jobs are very much at sort of the bottom of the ladder, so to speak, new jobs based on technology, so typing or shorthand, for which there was no precedent of male occupancy. The entrance of female clerical workers into what had previously been a male space caused a lot of concerns, such as these concerns were different from we've seen with munitions and land girls, but there were concerns nonetheless. So such concerns were reflected in the layout of the physical spaces of these offices. So historians have noted the lengths to which, in the late 19th century, employers went to ensure that male and female employees were segregated. Claire Rose's work on women office workers in the 1890s noted the fear of immorality that mixed offices could mean. And women were given separate rooms to work in. They were also made to enter work through different entrances than their male colleagues. Spatial segregation was often taken to absurd lengths. Most noticeably, the treasury, the women typists there were consigned to the attic, and they were not allowed out for lunch. When they weren't allowed out for lunch, I should say, by themselves. They did get a lunch break. Don't worry. However, when they did go out for lunch, they were escorted to and from lunch. It's been described as escorted in crocodile formation. In the savings bank department of the post office, men and women worked in different rooms, or if they were in the same room, it was separated and they were in different parts. So these concerns relating to the close proximity of male and female clerks was also reflected in their clothing and the type of clothing that was deemed appropriate for these female clerks to wear in the office. The journal, The Woman Clerk, reported how female workers were kept hidden and they were described as being smuggled in and out of the back entrances to the office. And a link was drawn to this decorous behaviour and the way in which the women were expected to dress in an appropriately covered way. So a bodice tightly buttoned down the front, a full long skirt and hat. The clothing they wore reflected broader concerns about the close proximity of male and female employees in the workplace. During the Edwardian years, the white blouse revolution saw an increase in the number of women entering the world of white-collar work, and it brought with it new professional practices and new forms of dress for these women. As Claire Rose has emphasised, it was important to these women to find a form of self-presentation that was professional, but without being unfeminine. So this need was met by new forms of dress, notably tailor-made costumes, which you can see up in these images. Women also wore sort of blouse and skirt combinations, hence the white blouse phrase, white blouse revolution. The fact that these women were all young and unmarried, Claire Rose says, added to the emphasis on their appearance. Now, the image here that you saw at the beginning, these are the offices of the WSPU. Going back to the first section on the suffragettes, they very much utilised the new technologies that were available for their propaganda campaigns. They used the telephone and the typewriter telegraph system and the improved postal system in their campaigns. And they recruited to work in the office many young girls who had been working as clerks, and they utilised their skills. So you can see here, these are all the clerks in the WSPU general offices. So emphasis on presentation and personal appearance of office workers continued during the interwar years. The interwar years were an era of growth in the ready-to-wear fashion industry. More and more women were wage earners who perhaps did not want to have time-wasting fittings at a dressmaker's, but had enough money to follow fashion and look beyond what was merely hard-wearing, practical and safe. Stores stocked moderately priced clothes and drew attention to this in adverts and catalogues. So what I've got up here, this advert on the left for Fine Furs is taken out of Red Tape. Red Tape was the magazine of the Civil Service Clerical Association. As you can see, we've got Fine Furs at special prices, aimed specifically at civil servants. So the additional service, if you notice at the bottom as well, includes free cleaning of any furs purchased. So this was put into the magazines that went out to these clerical workers. Fur at the time was highly fashionable. As you can see, this is from another advert in the same magazine taken around the same time to see this is not a full fur coat but the fur trim. So this was highly fashionable and highly desirable. Fashion retailing of the 1920s and 30s was transformed with the expansion of department stores and multiple stores. However, given the huge expansion in the range of shops from which women could make the clothing purchase, it was still the case that social class remained a critical factor in determining where women actually shopped and what they bought. Although stores such as Marks and Spencer's bought better quality clothing within the grasp of working class and lower middle class women, for the former, purchasing from such stores still represented very much a special investment and one not made regularly. So for many clerks, home dressmaking was still the main way in which to acquire new clothes. It was supplanted to some extent by mail order catalogues, such as Littlewood's, but many families still possessed or had access to sewing machines. And with the aid of paper patterns available with most women's magazines, women became quite apt at cutting and making their own clothes. This here is one such pattern, taken from Women's Outlook, which was the magazine of the Cooperative Women's Guild. This is for the early 30s, 1931, this image. So this is an afternoon frock. The text next to it said that this was for office or houseware. Women would send in this particular pattern, cost sixpence, and in stamps, they would quote the pattern number and the size, and then the paper pattern department of Women's Outlook in Manchester would send the pattern to them. It's got to be remembered that, of course, not all clerks in this period were on permanent contracts. Some were on wages so low that they found it very difficult to support themselves, especially if their work was intermittent. The Association of Women Clerks and Trade Unions, the Association of Women's Clerks was the trade union representing female clerks, and it campaigned on behalf of these women who were on temporary contracts and low wages. In its campaigns for increasing wages, one of the factors it used to frame the debates about wages was clothing and appearance that was required of these women. So, for example, in 1922, the association investigated various aspects of clerical workers' lives. And these included average salaries, accommodation, and personal expenditure. One of the factors the association examined was the cost of clothing for female clerks as a percentage of their salaries. The investigation explicitly linked clothing and health. It divided into a summer and a winter budget, and its report listed the clothing to be purchased if, quote, health is to be fully maintained. So this included in the winter stout shoes, business frock and hat, and in the summer lighter stockings, blouse and jumper. Other items included overcoats, raincoats and gloves. So this report also detailed the clothing budgets for a city woman clerk to, quote, provide appearance and health expected by city employers. So this included for winter a leather handbag, wool cardigan, warm gloves, umbrella, Macintosh. And for the summer, items included light stockings, silk handbag and white blouses. And the report of 1922 into this investigation concluded that there were large numbers of women clerks that on the budget committed by their low wages were underfed and underclothed. In 1937, the association was one such organisation representing office workers to launch a campaign for better working conditions and higher pay. This campaign, similar demands, minimum salary for all clerical workers, payment for overtime, and also the abolition of fee charging private employment agencies. So when some of these women were made redundant or laid off, or the contracts ended, there were employment agencies that would find them more clerical work, but they often charged them a fee, and the union wanted this to be abolished or for the employer to pay that. So in launching this campaign in 1937, Miss Anne Godwin, who was the secretary of the Association of Women Clerks and Secretaries, drew attention to the plight of many women typists and clerks, and she framed their low wages in the context of expectations again on their appearance. She stated that girls are expected to dress and look like Marlene Dietrich on 35 shillings a week. If they don't look smart and attractive, they soon lose their jobs. So again, the idea that there was, although not a uniform in terms of the uniforms we've seen with the munitions workers or the tram workers where everyone's wearing the same clothing, in white collar work there certainly was an expectation of dress, and there was sort of a type of clothing that we could think of as a uniform. So to conclude, an examination of the wardrobes of the suffragettes, of working women's clothing during the First World War, and the so-called white blouse revolution sheds light on the importance of clothing to women's emancipation in the early 20th century Britain. Debates concerning the political emancipation of women could be constructed around clothing, as demonstrated by the WSPU campaigns. Whereas specific modes of dress among female munition workers, the land girls and also clerks, became markers of professional identity. So in this way, the interrelated history of dress and labour, women's professional identity, are very closely entwined. Thank you.